And tonight we're going to do four of the actual disciples. All four of these guys were members of Jesus' 12 disciples. We're going to spend most of our time on the Apostle Thomas, because he has the best story. And really, of all the disciples, he probably has the best story of all. I've got behind me a map. I'll just be using that for reference so that you can see where all these folks went in their journeys. I know it's not particularly well lit up, but I'll help us walk through it as we go down that road. I'm not going to be reading the whole text of this tonight. I'll mostly be storytelling, but I wanted to write it all out because some of these stories are really great and they're worth remembering, so I wrote them out for you. But as always, we're going to start with Scripture. And the first scripture passage for us tonight is John chapter 11, verse 16. This is the one I just mentioned about Thomas. This happens during the story of Lazarus' death. They just hear about Lazarus dying. Lazarus just lives in Bethany, which is a suburb of Jerusalem. And the disciples know that if Jesus goes back to that area, he's likely to be arrested and killed just because of what the Jewish leaders have in for him. So this is after Jesus tells the disciples that he is going back to the Jerusalem area. Then Thomas, called Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." So the bad rap that Thomas gets for being doubting Thomas isn't entirely fair. He is also here a man of pretty remarkable courage. He wants to go and be faithful to his Lord, even in the face of death. The second verse I picked out for you is from Isaiah chapter 42, verses 10 through 13. This is one of the great Old Testament passages that speaks about the vision of missions that God has in plan for the world. "Sing to the Lord a new song, his praise from the ends of the earth. You who go down to the sea and all that is in it, you islands and all who live in them, let the desert and its towns raise their voices. Let them shout from the mountaintops. Let them give glory to the Lord and proclaim his praise in the islands. The Lord will march out like a mighty man. Like a warrior, he will stir up his zeal. With a shout, he will raise the battle cry and will triumph over his enemies." So you get a taste here of the firm resolution of God to bring his message to the nations so that all these places, the desert, the mountains, the islands, can rejoice in who he is. Now let's take a look at Thomas. And first let me give you some backstory for the disciples here. What we know from early tradition is that the disciples, after Pentecost happened, the disciples came together in their Jerusalem church and they said, "Well, the Lord has given us the Great Commission. He said, go into every nation and make disciples, preach the gospel, baptize them. And we feel like that's our personal duty, because Jesus gave this commission to us." So they decided to assign among themselves all the nations of the known world, and then go out from there and evangelize. And this makes good sense of the biblical evidence. In the Bible itself, you have the book of Acts getting started. And Peter's there, and John is there, and they lead the Jerusalem church for a few chapters. But they're the only disciples you really hear about. And even they go away after a few chapters. And James, the brother of Jesus, is leading the Jerusalem church. And you never hear about any of the other disciples. They're just gone off the map. They drop off the radar. Well, why is that? If they were leaders of the church, you would expect them to still be around. The reason that early tradition gives us is that they felt that they were missionaries, that the missionary call of God was their highest calling, and that God wanted his message to go out to the nations, and so they went. And we saw last week that Peter himself left Jerusalem and he went to Antioch and he ministered there. And he quite probably ministered in what's now Turkey. And he ended his life ministering in Rome. His accomplice Mark did many travels with Paul and with Peter and then ended his life ministering in Egypt. Thomas has an interesting story. Thomas gets assigned the country of India. And so here on our map, we've got Israel over here, and this is the Roman Empire on this side. So Greece would be right up there. This is Turkey. Israel is sort of along the eastern edge of the Roman Empire. This is about the dividing line right here. Over here is the Parthian Empire. This is their big rival. The Roman Empire and the Parthians, sometimes called the Persians, were always going at it. This would be modern-day Iran, mostly. And then beyond it, on the other side of the enemy empire, is India. India's down here. And they knew about India, and they had some trade connections with India. But almost no one from Israel actually ever went to India, because it's so far away. You're on the edge of the world out there. Thomas got assigned India when the disciples were splitting up the nations, and he decided that he didn't want to go. So he dragged his feet and he stuck around Jerusalem. And then he got a vision from the Lord in his sleep that said, Thomas, I want you to go to India and preach the gospel. And Thomas woke up the next day and he still didn't want to go. And he was wrestling with the Lord and dragging his feet. And so here's what the story says. This is kind of a cute story. I don't know if it's historically true or not. The Lord Jesus mustered up another resurrection appearance and came down to the streets of Jerusalem. Nearby where Thomas was. Thomas was in the streets of Jerusalem. And Jesus meets with this merchant who's come from the east, from about this area, what's now Pakistan. And this merchant has come at the request of an Indian king named Gundafar, whom we know of from history. We have coins left over from his reign. We have the ruins of buildings. We know he was a great builder. And he had sent an emissary to Israel because he had heard about the grandeur of their temple, the temple of Herod in Jerusalem, the temple that Herod had refurbished, was really one of the great architectural feats of the ancient world. And so he was trying to find a good Jewish craftsman, a Jewish builder, who could come and build a new palace for him in this style. And so Jesus, in the streets of Jerusalem, meets with this merchant, and he says to him, he says, look, I've got this bondservant who is heavily skilled at construction. Apparently that's Thomas's background, similar to Jesus's, carpenter, construction. He says, I'll sell him to you to go build this palace in India. And so the merchant agrees on it. So Thomas basically gets sold into slavery by Jesus so that he can go and fulfill his mission to the Indians. And after Thomas finds out about this, he actually gives up his grudging ways and he says, Lord, wherever you send me, I will go. So he goes, the tradition is that they take the land route, which probably would have gone up here, up through Mesopotamia, down through the enemy empire. This is probably one of the reasons why Thomas didn't want to go. Down through the Parthian Empire and over here to this corner of the Indus River Valley. It's where Pakistan is now. And he becomes employed by King Gundafar. And the story, which I've written out for you below, is kind of a cute story. King Gundafar commissions to build him this new palace. And he shows him the site where he wants it built, and he gives him a whole bunch of money to get started on it, and then he goes back to his normal place of residence. So Thomas takes all this money, and instead of buying materials, he goes out and he gives the money away to the poor, and he starts preaching the gospel. A few weeks later, King Gundafar sends a messenger. He says, well, how's it going? And Thomas says, it's going great, but more can be added. We can do more. So the king sends him a whole bunch more gold and silver. And Thomas does the same thing again. He takes all the money, and instead of building anything with it, he gives it out to the poor. And he continues preaching. He continues winning converts to Christianity. So eventually, King Gundafar comes down himself to the town, and he's met by some of his friends who warn him and say, listen, King, we don't think that your guy has actually been doing his job. So Gundafar calls Thomas in and says, did you build the palace I asked you to build? And Thomas says, yeah, I built it. And Gundafar says, well, can you show me where it is? Well, let me go see it. And Thomas says, no, you can't see it now, but after you die, then you'll see it. So the idea being that by giving away his money in alms, he has won a heavenly reward for the king. The story goes on from there that the King Gundafar is enraged. He wants to kill Thomas. He throws Thomas in jail. But before he can actually carry out the execution, King Gundafar's brother drops dead, or seems to drop dead. And he has what now we would call a near-death experience. And so he sees angels when he dies. And he gets shown this gorgeous palace. And he says to the angels, "Oh, can I live there?" And they said, "Well, no, you can't live there. You have to live over here in this other section." And he says, "Well, why not?" And they say, "Well, that's the palace for your brother." And at that point, he sort of comes back to himself. He wakes back up, resuscitates. And he goes to his brother, King Gundafar, and he says, "Will you please sell me your heavenly palace? I'll do anything. It's worth more than your whole realm." And so on the basis of this, King Gundafar actually forgives Thomas and is convinced and converts to Christianity. So we don't know exactly if that story is entirely historically accurate or if it's a nice fable, but it's a good story, isn't it? What we do know historically is that Thomas, from this area, then took a boat and came down to this part of India, the western coast, what's now called Kerala. And this coast of Kerala, he landed there and he started preaching the gospel. And the gospel took great root there. They did have some trading contacts, so there were translators there who would have understood the Greek that Thomas would have been able to speak. According to tradition, he won 17,000 converts to the gospel of Jesus Christ in that place. And the remarkable thing is that little pocket of Christians surrounded by Hindus and later on by Muslims up here in this area, that little pocket of Christians has survived and thrived for 2,000 years, and they're still there. That section of Kerala is still Christian, and they call themselves the St. Thomas Christians, the Mar Thoma churches in their language, and they trace this history back all the way to the first century and Thomas. And it's a pretty reputable historical argument. We have good evidence for it, because other missionaries go over about 200 years later, 300 years later, and they find these guys there. And they say, "Yeah, we're Christians. St. Thomas brought us the gospel." They're still there to this day. In fact, when I was in seminary, I went to a Baptist seminary, but one of my favorite advisors, he wasn't actually employed by the seminary. He sort of came in to help out with one of the classes I took on readings from spiritual classics. And he was a Colorado guy, grew up in Colorado, but in... when he was in college, he had met someone from a Mar Thoma church, an Indian Christian from this St. Thomas group. And that's what won him to the gospel. And he became a priest in that tradition. So he's a priest of the St. Thomas churches. And we got to talk with him and learn from him about his heritage. And it was really neat. But Thomas actually didn't stop there. I mean, already, you know, they don't have cars or planes in those days, so he's already traveled by foot all this distance, which would have taken probably a couple of years anyway, and then by boat down here. And then he travels by foot across the subcontinent of India, which is basically undiscovered country at this point for Romans. There weren't any contacts on this side, so he's going to unreached people groups on the eastern side, and he comes near to where the city of Mylapore is, and he preaches again, and he wins more converts. And it's at that point where he, like most of the other disciples, is martyred for the faith. The tradition is that he upsets the local officials by his preaching, and four soldiers come with spears, and they kill him with spears. And so you see in his hand there, he's holding a spear. And there's a great tradition in the art of Christianity to depict martyrs with the manner of their death. So he's holding a spear. And part of this is that and we're going to talk about this in just a minute, to us, martyrdom and focusing on the means of martyrdom might seem a little bit gruesome or macabre. But to them in the first century, these were the heroes, the stars of the Christian world. And to remember how they died, to what lengths they went for the gospel of Jesus Christ, was the greatest inspiration they had. We're going to see that in just a minute with these other guys. So you can turn the page over. I've got three others of Jesus' disciples here. And we don't have quite as detailed stories about them, but we know where they went and what they did. And the cool thing about these guys is that they did their own solo missions for a while. They also teamed up with one another. They partnered up with one another for evangelistic tours. Like if Billy Graham and Luis Palau got together and did a tour together today. So they would partner up with one another. They would go it alone. And their main goal was to get the gospel out. So the first one there is Bartholomew. You can see the picture here. This is actually a painting that I got to see in the Classical Art Museum in Budapest when I was over there in November. And just a quick note, Bartholomew, most scholars and tradition equates this with Nathanael. And so if you always thought that one of Jesus' disciples was Bartholomew and another one was Nathanael, our best guess is that they're probably the same guy, and he's just referred to by different names. The reason why is that Bartholomew appears in the first three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, as one of the 12 disciples when you get the full list of 12, and Nathanael does not appear. But Bartholomew is always talked about in connection with Philip in those Gospels. When you get to John's Gospel, Bartholomew is never mentioned, but this guy Nathanael is. And Nathanael is always hanging around with Philip. And so the supposition is, and this is what early tradition tells us too, is that Bartholomew and Nathanael were just two names for the same guy. So Bartholomew, one of the 12 disciples, but doesn't show up in the New Testament story after Pentecost. Let me actually read this note here. I'm down to the second sentence. According to early tradition, this is because he, along with many other apostles, soon left the Jerusalem church to begin their missionary journeys. He had been assigned to the regions to the east in the direction of the Parthian Empire, modern Iran. So he evangelized through Mesopotamia and Parthia. So this would be his route. Like Thomas, he starts out here, and he would have gone up through the Fertile Crescent and done his main work right in here, what we would now call Iraq. He ministered in here, and then he came over through the Parthian Empire, kind of close to where Thomas ended up. In fact, 200 years after the disciples went, the Church of Alexandria sent out another missionary, a man named Pantanus. So he came from here and he went over, and he discovered a group of Christians living right around this area. And they said, yeah, we've been here. We were given the gospel by the disciple Bartholomew. And in fact, he tells the story that they had in their possession a copy of the Gospel of Matthew, written in either Aramaic or Hebrew, that Bartholomew had left with them. And so there's probably some historical evidence to that. So Bartholomew goes down here, he preaches around the Parthian Empire. Once again, this was enemy territory, so this is an act of great courage. And then he comes up here and goes to Armenia. This is where he's most well known. And Armenia it's smaller today, the country of Armenia. We have a modern country by the same name, which is smaller than what you see here, but it's right next to Turkey. And if you've been following the news, Armenia has been in the news in the past couple weeks because Pope Francis went over and he gave a speech and he referred to something in Armenian history as a genocide. And this is a big debate in our world today. In 1915, the Ottoman Turks slaughtered hundreds of thousands of Armenians. And the debate is whether you call it genocide or whether you use a different word for it. Pope Francis called it genocide. I've researched that event. I would call it genocide too. But a lot of our politicians Can't say genocide because then we'll make our ally Turkey mad, and I guess we need all the allies we can get over there right now. Anyway, Armenia's been on the news. This is where it is. And according to tradition, Bartholomew went there and he preached. And this is where he hooked up with his good friend, Jude Thaddeus, fellow disciple. Jude Thaddeus and Bartholomew got together and they said, let's do our next tour of preaching in Armenia. Armenia was this mountainous region. It's very isolated. It's always sort of been stuck between the Roman Empire and the Parthian Empire, and neither of them ever get full control over it because it's so hard to manage up there in the mountains. And they have their own pagan religion that they follow. But this is where they want to go, and they preach the gospel, and they win converts. But this is where Bartholomew meets his end. He is martyred, and he is martyred by being skinned alive. And here's the macabre part of it. If you look at his painting, if you saw this in color, you would see that his body below his head is actually all red. And that thing draped over him isn't a cloak, it's actually his skin that he's holding. So this is to remind us of the way that he perished. He was skinned alive. And a terrible way to meet your fate, but a testament to how deeply he believed in the message of Jesus Christ. Most of us, if we faced anything like that, we would be seriously tempted to recant, I imagine. But Bartholomew was faithful to the end. He and Jude Thaddeus are considered apostolic founders of the Armenian church. There is still an ancient Armenian church in practice in that country. It is actually one of the Christian denominations that helps administer the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, which is the church where we believe Jesus' tomb is located. And the remarkable thing about it is that here's Armenia, tiny little country stuck in here. Everything over here, everything to up about that line, everything over here and over here and over here and down here, it's all Muslim. Except for Armenia, right there. For 2,000 years, they've kept the gospel of Jesus Christ as given to them by Bartholomew and Jude, and they've kept it in the face of Muslim empires all around them. So a tremendous story of effective ministry there. Jude Thaddeus is the next guy. We've already talked about him a little bit. A quick note on him too, because once again, the lists of disciples in the Gospels are confusing in that they don't always match up exactly. So tradition tells us that this is the disciple who is called Jude, or is sometimes called Thaddeus, or is sometimes called Jude Thaddeus. But it's not the same Jude as the Jude who wrote Jude in our Bibles. That Jude is a different Jude, presumably a half-brother of Jesus, as far as we know. So Jude Thaddeus, one of the 12 disciples, again, like Bartholomew, he's not mentioned. He's hardly mentioned in the Gospels and not mentioned again in the book of Acts. According to tradition, he receives as his mission field the regions immediately around Judea. Tradition tells us that he evangelized in the areas that are now Syria and Lebanon, as well as joining with Bartholomew for the mission to Armenia. So he gets to stick a little bit closer to home. He ministers right here. Lebanon would have been the area that the Phoenician people and their descendants lived during that time. Syria was mostly Roman, but it had some interesting tribes out here, unreached tribes called the Nabataeans, that Jude Thaddeus ministered to as well. So he went up to Armenia. He survived the mission in Armenia. Bartholomew did not. And Jude Thaddeus went to minister. He came back down here, and he decided to partner with another disciple, Simon the Zealot, who we'll talk about in a minute. Simon the Zealot came up to minister with him in Lebanon, and they were both martyred there in the city of Beirut, which is the modern capital of Lebanon. And according to tradition, he was killed with an axe, which is why he's holding on to a big battle axe in his picture there. The other neat thing about Jude Thaddeus is that according to these traditions, he was known as a prayer warrior. He was one of these guys that prayed all the time. And when he prayed, incredible things happened. And that was preserved in tradition. And so the Orthodox and the Catholic churches who like to remember great saints and often invoke their help. You know, we as Baptists don't do that, but it's a testament to the character of this man. They drew their inspiration from his prayer life. And this is why Jude is often called the patron saint of hopeless causes. Which is, I don't know what you think about that title.
Wasn't that the one Danny Thomas built that hospital?
Yeah, that's why St. Jude is often seen as the patron saint of children's hospitals or sort of critical care hospitals, St. Jude's. It's because of this reason, because he was known as a man of such great prayer that you could, if you believed in appealing to the saints, you could appeal to St. Jude and he would pray for you and amazing things would happen. So anyway, that's why so many things are named after St. Jude, Jude Thaddeus. The last one we have here tonight is Simon the Zealot. He's also called Simon the Canaanite in the Gospels. Although almost nothing is known about him from the New Testament, one early tradition claims that he was the bridegroom at the wedding in Cana, and that he and his bride both became followers of Jesus after that miracle. We don't know if that's true or not, but it's an interesting connection. And the story goes that because he saw the water turn to wine, and he saw Jesus do this remarkable miracle, he and his bride both left their homes behind, left this settled new life, no doubt they were hoping for, and both joined Jesus' group of followers. And this is why he became known as Simon the Zealot, because he did this sort of reckless, zealous thing to follow Jesus. He left his life behind. We don't know much about him, but we do know this. After Pentecost, he became a missionary to Egypt and Libya before partnering with Jude Thaddeus in Lebanon, where he too was martyred by being sawed to death. So you have the painting there, and you see Simon the Zealot is in the middle, and the two guys beside him are working a saw through his body. And if you ever see a statue of a saint with a giant saw, that's Simon the Zealot. He's always pictured that way because of the way he met his end. And once again, they don't give us these details about the martyrdoms to gross us out or to, I don't know. But the idea here is that you see the lengths that these guys went to for the gospel of Jesus Christ. I mean, this is some of our greatest evidence for the reality of the story that's passed down to us. That, you know, we don't have a religion where, you know, half the guys who were there at the beginning sort of wandered away from it in the end. No, they all stuck to their guns. They believed that they had seen this absolutely transformational event, the resurrection of a man they knew had died. And they were so convinced of it that they went to horrible, horrible deaths for the sake of this cause. And not just for the sake of the cause of Christ, but because they loved the nations. And we too, in our efforts at missions, with these guys being our inspiration, we can't be half-hearted in the way we embrace missions. Because missions is Jesus' call to these people, his disciples, his friends. And they believed in it strongly enough that they gave up everything. And they wandered around enemy territory. And they gave up normal family lives. And ultimately, they went to terrible deaths for the sake of reaching the lost with the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so, if we are going to call ourselves disciples of Jesus as well, we need to make sure that we are reflecting the kind of life that these guys lived, the passion for souls that they demonstrated. So that's the story of these guys. So basically, among them, they were able to evangelize this whole giant area, including this part right here with Simon the Zealot, Egypt and Libya. Next time we do this, at some point next month, there's a few more disciples left, and we'll see that they went up into this area, what's now Europe, and preached the gospel up there as well. But that's the story of these four guys, and I thought a fitting hymn to sing in response to these stories would be number 727. This is the hymn, Faith is the Victory, and it speaks about the faith that we have, the call to go out, and that our faith is the victory that overcomes the world. So number 727, Faith is the victory. And if you're able, please stand once again for this final hymn.